WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The current hit film comedy, Honeymoon in Vegas, was written and directed by my guest, Andrew Bergman. Bergman also wrote and directed the comedy The Freshman, in which Marlon Brando did a comic turn on his Mafia Don role in The Godfather. Bergman's other screenplays include Fletch, The In-Laws, and Soap Dish. He co-wrote the screenplay for Blazing Saddles with Mel Brooks. Before we meet Bergman, let's hear a scene from Honeymoon in Vegas. Nicolas Cage and Sarah Jessica Parker play a couple who've come to Las Vegas to get married. But Cage is still edgy about making the big commitment. James Caan plays a con man who thinks Sarah Jessica Parker looks just like his beloved late wife. So he tricks Cage into a card game in which Cage loses big. Caan is willing to absolve the debt if Cage loans him his fiancée for the weekend. And of course, Cage has no choice but to reluctantly agree. As Parker packs her bags for this dreaded weekend, Cage is a nervous wreck.
It's only for a few days.
Come on. You're so, like, blithe about this all of a sudden. Like, you don't give a damn!
Of course I give a damn, but this was not my idea, okay, Jack? Poker was not my idea.
Would you please stop crucifying me with this?
My bag.
He's gonna jump all over you the second he gets there.
Oh, no, let him, please, Jack. Give me a little credit.
He'll overcome you. I mean, what happens if you start screaming? It's like a jungle over there! He probably has servants and bodyguards, and believe me, they will drug you!
His son is gonna be there, Jack. His granddaughter, Tiffany, will be there.
She knows the kid's name already.
What was your original idea for the movie? What was the first part of it that you came up with? The new movie.
The first part was very simple. It was just boy-girl. I've had tendency to do movies which were sort of, I don't like to say the word buddy films, but they've been sort of very male films, from Blazing Saddles for The In-Laws and even The Freshman, you know, older man, father-son. I really wanted to do a boy-girl story. So that was the initial impulse. And then I had this idea, well, this guy's going to lose his girlfriend in a poker game. And when I mentioned at the time to my agent, he sort of turned pale, you know, and he said, well, this is 1990s. You can't do something like that. I said, it won't be what you think. So that was the original impulse, was really to do something which was pretty simple and not have Komodo dragons in it and some completely baroque plot which it would take me 2 years to figure out.
Is that what happened with The Freshman?
It was the hardest. I wrote that script over a period of 3 years. I just kept painting myself into a corner. I never had any idea how I was going to get out of it.
Well, there were all these shifting identities and subplots.
Yeah. It's a very complicated script.
So let me ask you your agent's question. Why did you think you could get away with having a guy lose his girl in a poker game?
Because I knew I would do it in such a way as to not offend, I think. I it was never intended to be. You know, people see the premise of, oh, what a sexist kind of thing. But it really, it isn't at all when you see the movie.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you have Sarah Jessica Parker plays really a very independent girl. She wants to get married. She tells Nicolas Cage she wants to get married. She's calling the shots. And the turning point in her relationship with Jimmy Caan, who takes her off to Hawaii, is really that he really treats her like a possession, basically. He walks around with her like a possession, and that's something that she can't just tolerate. So she's a completely contemporary person, and she goes off with Jimmy not because she's been traded off, but out of rage. You know, it's her decision to go off to Hawaii with Jimmy Caan.
You have many Elvis impersonators
many.
In the movie. How did you get them into the story, and then how did you find them once you wrote them in?
I always wanted to do a movie which took place during a convention of Elvis impersonators. Always. And this was
why?
Because I just thought visually it would be a wonderful thing to see.
Mm-hmm.
That every time the elevator opened, five Elvises would walk out. You walk past the newsstand and there's three Elvises reading newspapers. And in Vegas, of course, nothing is out of place. You know, if there were 100 people naked in the lobby, it wouldn't be out of place in Vegas. Vegas is a place in which nothing can be out of place, you know. And they fit in, you know, it was like lions in the jungle. It was their natural habitat.
So did you find the Elvis impersonators, or did you ask people to play
them? Oh, we
them
did
as
a
well?
Sort of calling all Elvises search, and we got tapes from all over the country, all over the world, really, you know, our casting people.
Nicolas Cage gives a fantastic performance in Honeymoon in Vegas. Was it your idea to cast him?
Well, that was my idea to cast everybody because I'm the director. But, I mean, originally he was not my thought. you know, Nick's movies have been so out there, you know, eating roaches and all those things he's done in pictures that when you do a romantic comedy, the first name that would not have popped in my head was Nicolas Cage. But when he read the script and really had a fierce desire to do it, which a director always likes, because when you have to talk someone into doing a part, it never turns out well. It's just something you don't want to do. Because if things ever go bad on a picture, and at some point they always do, you have an actor who says, I knew it, you know. So in this case, I would never have had that problem. And the other thing was he came in and read, and he just was this guy. I mean, he owned the part. And there was just no question from that moment on that he was going to play, you know, Jack Singer in the movie.
Were there particular line readings that really surprised you in where he put the accent or how he'd go from loud to soft in one paragraph?
Well, Nick can just go off on a dime, which is what I love about him, you know. And in the movie, he is so harried that it never seems completely inappropriate. He did a line reading on when he visits this Hawaiian chief played by Peter Boyle in the movie. In which Pat Morita is this cab driver who is taking him there for the purpose of diverting him. And he lives in this rundown, ramshackle place. And Nick doesn't want to set foot in the place. And Pat Morita says, you really should be respectful to him. He's a man of great influence on this island. And Nick did this reading. He said, influence? He lives in a shack! And he exploded on the word shack. And when he did it, the first take was ruined because the producer who was sitting listening to earphones just broke out laughing. It was so funny. So he has a wonderful way of just exploding, literally exploding on a particular word.
Well, it must be fun for you as the writer to hear somebody like bring the words to life in such a surprising way.
Nick does it as well as anybody I have ever worked with. In fact, I think not since Peter Falk in The In-Laws did I ever work with an actor who just absolutely had ingested the rhythms of what I had written and just did it. You know, it's like, you know, music to my ears. He really nailed everything. Also, Nick has fabulous diction. I mean, you understand every word he says, which is, you know, not the common thing in movies nowadays. You know, when you're straining to hear what actors are saying half the time, Nick really knocks him out.
My guest is Andrew Bergman, who wrote and directed Honeymoon in Vegas and also The Freshman. I want to ask you about The Freshman, your film from a couple of years ago, where Matthew Broderick plays a young man from Vermont who's going to New York to study in film school. And within a minute of arriving in New York, all of his possessions are ripped off in a scam. And then he's soon involved in what he figures is the mafia, which is headed by Marlon Brando, looking suspiciously like Don Corleone. There's a great scene, a couple of scenes with his film teacher and faculty advisor, who's incredibly pretentious.
Right.
And the first time we see this film teacher, it's in his office, and Matthew Broderick has come in to explain he doesn't have any money to buy books. And the teacher's listening to Shuffle Off to Buffalo, which has the line, and the wheels go slow, soon we're going to shuffle off to Buffalo. And he explains that he's writing a paper called And the Wheels Go Slow, Film and Function in 42nd Street.
Right.
I thought that was a wonderfully funny line. And then, of course, I found out that you did your dissertation on Depression-era movies, and that's called We're in the Money. Was this a little joke on yourself?
Fleabag is there but for the grace of God, go on. I mean, I would have been Professor Fleabag. In fact, one of the props in that scene was he had my book on his desk, We're in the Money, which I wrote 20 years ago, and which, amazingly enough, is still in print. So it was really sort of a joke on myself. I mean, Fleabag was sort of one of my own worst visions of what I probably would have turned into if I'd continued in the path that I had chosen.
Well, there's another wonderful scene where, you know, the professor, you know, Fleabag is showing Godfather 2
right.
to the class, and he's like lip-syncing with all the parts on the side of the room.
I'm Senator. You can have my answer now if you like. My offer is this. Nothing. Not even the fee for the gaming license, which I would appreciate if you would put up personally.
Senator, my offer is this. Nothing. In that one moment, Michael Corleone says that all corruption is equal, that there is no separation between politics and gangsterism. Now, in the Fleabag treatise, Guns and Provolone,
What point is made about the similarities between Karl Marx's Das Kapital, Immanuel Kant's Critique of Pure Reason, and the Lake Tahoe scene from Godfather 2, Mr. Kellogg?
Sir.
You haven't read the Fleaver piece?
Well, I'm... in an evolving
You need
society.
Tutorial help from Mr. Bushek?
No, sir.
Mr. Glassman.
In an evolving society, violence and narcissism replace rational...
Shut up!
I hate this guy.
Did you have teachers like this when you were in film school?
Everybody. I was never in film
school.
You
were never in film school?
No, never in film school. Okay. But everybody's had teachers like this. If it's not in film, it's in something else. Overbearing guys who you instantly know in your gut are full of it, but you still, even after the first class, know you're going to have to spend 14 weeks in purgatory with these people. So Fleaver, I really had fun with Fleaver. And poor Benedict, who played him, was just unbelievably funny, I thought. I just loved him. When he gives the speech, he starts off by trying to sound like Pacino. You know, that's the other joke within the film, within the film. He does his own pitiful parody of Al giving that speech. It was really fun.
Now, your major at the University of Wisconsin was American Intellectual History. What exactly were you planning to do with that?
Well, what does anybody plan to do with American Intellectual History? I guess be an American intellectual, you know, and look good in tweed suits. And get tasseled loafers, you know, Basswegians, and think thoughts. What I liked about American Intellectual History was the research and going into primary documents and digging through things. And actually, the book on movies was fascinating to do because I was sort of rummaging around all kinds of stuff. You know, it's like rummaging around the attic of the 1930s. And making connections with all kinds of things in literature and popular literature, so it was really interesting work. I thought when I was in college, I thought I'd get a degree and then I'd wind up advising a president. You know I went to college in the '60s, and I thought, boy, I'd like to be Ted Sorensen when I grow up. You know, sit there next to Kennedy and tell him how to be a genius. I thought that's what I would do.
So tell me something about your thesis on Depression era movies.
Well, I mean, the thesis was that in the early 30s, when things were really desperate, what the movies did in different forms was to keep alive the great American success stories. And what I did when I studied a movie like Little Caesar, for instance, I compared it to Horatio Alger stories. I compared it to this essay that Andrew Carnegie had written about success in the 19th century. And I found that what Edward G. Robinson did in that movie was everything that Andrew Carnegie said you had to do to be a success. Stayed away from women, very disciplined, no booze. He worked very hard. He just, in the early 30s, to start a small business and be successful when 37 million people were out of work wouldn't have been credible. So to me, gangster stories were success stories. And then as things got perceived as better in the mid-30s, things started to shift. And the government became a character in a lot of movies and in Warner Brothers movies and began to seem as benevolent. But if you look at movies in the very early 30s, they're very scary. I mean, you can see the amount of terror that was floating around.
Yeah, of course, these guys are all punished for their success.
Ultimately.
Yeah. Of course, they had to be, I guess, because of the Hays Code.
Exactly.
So how did you go from writing about movies to writing movies?
Well, the first good thing that happened to me was I couldn't get a teaching job. That was my first break. So I went to work for United Artists for a year as a PR guy, and I met a lot of really fascinating people because at that time United Artists was releasing something like 35 movies a year. And I met Fellini, I met Truffaut, all these people I was spending time with. And it was a great education. I made a lot of contacts. And during that time, I wrote the story that became Blazing Saddles. It's an idea I'd had for years of a black sheriff in the Old West. And I sold it to Warner Brothers, and I never worked an honest day in my life again.
You know, the scene that always gets talked about the most is the bean scene where they're sitting around eating beans and then sitting around passing a lot of air.
Right.
But I love things like the quicksand. You know, I mean, there's quicksand in every Western of a certain period, you know. And I, you know, you could tell me quicksand doesn't exist and I'd believe you, you know, but for some reason it had to be in every Western.
It was always one of my nightmares as a kid.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, quicksand. I mean, it's the scariest thing you can think of, you know. I mean, the thing about Blazing Saddles is, you know, now in retrospect, critics write about it as you know, this seminal picture, but we got blasted when it came out. I mean, some critics liked it, but we got roasted a lot.
I think my favorite moment in the movie is when the chain gang, you know, the prisoners are asked to, like, sing a work song, and they break out into
Cole
I
Porter.
Get a Kick Out of You. Yeah.
It's great.
What was it like when that idea was generated?
You know, it's... You just don't know anymore,
right?
Because at that point there are five people sitting around a room throwing these things around, and it's like a game of telephone. It starts as one thing, and a half hour later it's something else, and you don't know anymore what was yours and what was someone else's, and it didn't really make any difference. It was pretty egoless, the writing on that picture.
Well, let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. And my guest is Andrew Bergman, and he wrote and directed Honeymoon in Vegas and The Freshman. He wrote So Fine and The In-Laws, and he also wrote the story for Blazing Saddles. So more after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Screenwriter and director Andrew Bergman is my guest. His current film is the hit Honeymoon in Vegas. I want to get back to a couple of things about The Freshman and see how they connect with you. Was it hard to get Marlon Brando to work on the film and to basically do an almost parody version of Don Corleone, his role in The Godfather?
Well, he wanted to play it that way, so I didn't have to twist his arm. It was his idea. I didn't write that script for Brando originally. I mean, because who would think he was doing movies anymore? I thought that, you know, Pacino or Joe Mantegna, or one of those guys, would play it. When he finished the script, we basically sent it to Brando on the off chance that he'd want to do it. And he called me the day after he got the script and said he was interested. So it was not at all difficult to get him to do it. See, I don't think it's thought of as a parody of that character. But I always thought he started with that guy and then we took him somewhere else. I mean, if you look at The Godfather and you look at The Freshman, he's a very different guy. It's sort of the Falstaff version of Don Corleone. I mean, I think it's one of the best things Brando ever did, if you consider what the expectations were and where he took that guy.
I've seen the documentary about the making of Apocalypse Now.
Yeah,
and
it's a fabulous movie.
Yeah, and in that you see...
Brando torturing Francis.
Exactly. And you see him trying to, like, improvise and then saying to Coppola, "I'm sorry, I can't do this anymore today." And I'm thinking, wow, I mean, this guy is a brilliant actor, but gee, he must be awfully difficult to work with.
Well, he wasn't difficult for me to work with. But, I mean, improvising, I don't believe in it. I mean,
well, you're the writer. I can see why.
Well, not just for that. It doesn't work. I mean, it just doesn't work. It's interminable. I mean... they're actors for a reason, and they're writers for a reason. They're two separate functions. I mean, and none of the actors in Honeymoon, nor did any of the actors in Freshman, have any desire to improvise. They were very happy with the lines, you know. I mean, there's always leeway, you know. But it makes no more sense to me for actors to improvise than for me to get up and start acting. They're very separate things. I mean... It can be good in rehearsal because you can find things. But once the cameras are rolling, I'm not a big believer in it at all.
What about Brando? Did he want to improvise?
No, not at all. He loved the lines.
So was it difficult to work with him?
No. It was. You know, sometimes I wake up in the middle of the night, like 2 weeks before shooting, and said, "What am I doing? Am I out of my mind?" You know, I've heard this guy said just a director eater and But he was wonderful. I mean, he took direction, you know, he was craving direction, I guess because he hadn't done much comedy. And he didn't feel as secure in it. But he was just wonderful, and he couldn't have been better to the other actors. I mean, he was wonderful. You know, when he do off-camera things, you know, when someone else is close-up, you know, some actors just basically do nothing because they're not on screen. But he would be working as hard as he could. He was wonderful. He was just absolutely wonderful. And it shows on screen. His pleasure in the part, he's astounding. You know, he rehearsed ice skating. I mean, this is a guy's reputation for hating to work. He would go practice ice skating every day. It was quite wonderful.
He gave an interview, I think, right before the movie opened.
No, it was the day after shooting. He'd fallen on the ice and hurt his neck.
Uh-huh.
And I have a feeling he had sucked on too much Percodan before he gave this interview. It was always my theory. And he was having this dispute with the TriStar because they thought he thought they owed him an extra, I don't know what it was, $50,000 because he worked an extra day. And he gets some environmental reporter from the Toronto Star in there, and he just went bonkers, you know. And then he retracted it. Now, of course, the retraction was carried in, you know, 4 newspapers in the world. But it was a disaster. It was just, and he has this self-destructive thing. I mean, he does it all the time. He just did it on Columbus, saying what a terrible picture it was. I mean, in that case, it turned out to be true.
So what did he say about the Freshman? He said the film's going to be a flop.
He said the film's going to be a flop. It was a terrible experience. I mean, none of which was true. I mean, he'd had the time of his life doing it. And he couldn't have been better to work with. It was just, you know, a very self-destructive and idiotic thing to do.
So do you know what you're going to be doing next?
There are a couple of things I'm considering. One is a very old idea, and one is something I'm just working on. I would love to do something political. We were talking about advising presidents before.
Yeah.
I think we're ripe for a really good, dark political comedy. There hasn't been a good one since Strangelove, in my humble opinion, and I would love to do one.
Is it hard to do in Hollywood?
I don't. I I'm coming off a hit, so when you,
right,
you know, if you have a hit picture, then you have the luxury of saying, "I'd like to do a movie called The Lawn next," and they say, "That sounds interesting." The Lawn, it could be good. Is this like a big lawn, or just like a backyard thing? So I don't know. So that's the, you know, the luxury of having a movie that's number one is that they're quicker to say yes to something.
Yeah, it's been number one for a couple of weeks.
Yeah.
What else does that get you?
I think that's the main thing it gets you. It's not, I mean, if it hadn't been successful, it wouldn't be that I would never work in this town again. You know, The Freshman wasn't commercially all that successful, but it, you know, here I was 2 years later making a movie. But what a hit gives you, someone says it gives you 3 flops. You know, I can make 3 turkeys in a row, but I'll still say, you know, he made Honeymoon in Vegas, and that really did very well. So there's always a chance. It just gives you breathing room is what it does. It means the studios say, well, it's worth taking a shot. You know, this looks crazy, but who knows, you know? Honeymoon in Vegas looked crazy, and look what happened.
Andrew Bergman wrote and directed Honeymoon in Vegas. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.